Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, spring is a great time for dogs to be outside. Also, the start of the tick season in Wisconsin. And we're going to be talking about Lyme disease in dogs from diagnosis to prevention and treatment with our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. So, questions about Lyme disease in dogs, other pet health questions, I hope you'll join in our conversation. We've been having a few problems with our phones this morning. I see Chris from Lake Geneva is already on board, but if you have trouble getting through by phone, you can always, and the phone number, by the way, is 1-800-642-1234. Give that a try. But you can also email us your questions and, of course, your pet photos to ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
So tell us about Lyme disease in dogs. What are the...
Well, this is the time of the year that we're doing a lot of just regular screening. And it's because, I don't know why, but typically in the springtime, we have a lot of dogs that are coming in to have their annual heartworm test done, which is a parasite spread by mosquitoes. We're talking about a disease called Lyme disease that's spread by ticks. But the test that many veterinarians use is a combination test that not only looks at heartworm, but looks at different tick diseases that we have in this area too. At the clinic that I work at the vet school, we do something called the 4DX test, which looks at Lyme, anaplasma, which is another deer tick-borne disease, and Ehrlichia, as well as heartworm. So we're doing this screening on all these healthy dogs that we're just not expecting to find anything wrong with them. And it's often a surprise, not only for us, but for the owners, especially for the owners, to find out that their dog has tested positive for Lyme. And all that means is that the dog has been exposed weeks to months, sometimes before we ran the test. Because initially, when they're first exposed to a tick, it does take several weeks before they will test positive. So when we get this positive back, the first thing we like to look at is this dog symptomatic for Lyme disease or is it asymptomatic? And, you know, your classic dog with clinical Lyme disease has fever and lameness, often multiple joints involved and multiple legs involved. They're really depressed. And if they're really unlucky, there's a rare condition called Lyme nephritis, which is a inflammatory disease of the kidneys, which is a horrible disease for dogs to get. And so if they're symptomatic, we have an answer, and we usually say, let's just go ahead and start treatment. But it's those dogs that are coming in wagging their tails and not limping. What do we do with them? Number one, improve your tick control. Because this happened weeks to months earlier, if I got a dog in today that tested Lyme positive, was negative last year, it could have been exposed any time during the deer tick season. And guess when that was? Any time in the last year. We don't have a non-tick season for deer ticks.
So it's all 12 months.
Yep. I tell my owners that we don't need 365 days of tick control, but we do need 12 months because even in those cold January and February months, there are the odd day where the temperatures will get above freezing. And in deer ticks love that cooler temperature. And if there's very little or light snow cover, they'll come up and quest, meaning they climb up on any dead plant material and hope that someone's going to walk by and brush past them so that they can jump on and or actually they don't jump, but they'll just hold on with their legs and find a host and start feeding right away. So we need in this area tick control 12 months out of the year. And so that's usually the first thing that we have to correct is get this dog on better tick control. And there's lots of great products out there, and we can talk about those later as to what is available and what works. But with these asymptomatic dogs, the one thing that I will always want to check is because even though it's uncommon to get this kidney-type disease secondary to Lyme, which is a kind of a unique problem for dogs, is we check a urine sample. And so I take that dog out for a walk, get a urine sample, and not only check it to make sure that it's healthy and happy and normal, but I also do a special test called a urine protein creatinine ratio to look at the amount of protein that the dog is passing. Because if that error, that value is increased, that would give me more, you know, I'd be more inclined to start treating this dog. And we usually treat with a drug called doxycycline. But for the majority of dogs, if they are asymptomatic, their urine is normal, we don't treat.
Yeah.
It's very different than in the human world because Lyme, actual clinical Lyme disease is quite uncommon in dogs compared to people. In humans, you get bit by a tick, they'll often put you on doxycycline. In our world, because so many dogs walk around positive but asymptomatic, we don't usually treat. And this is where it becomes a little controversial because you're, you know, it's owners want to see their dog, they're seeing this test be positive and they want to get them on medication. But typically, yeah, we don't have to do that.
Well, let's, you know, Chris from Lake Geneva, she has some questions relating to what you were just talking about. So maybe let's go there. Chris, hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks for having me. I've heard a lot. My dog has been picking up ticks. She's a Springer Spaniel. I haven't had a dog in 20 years, so I'm getting used to finding ticks on her. I usually keep them. I throw them in a plastic bag to see if they're living. Most of them die, and she's on NexGard.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm wondering about is I've heard a lot about this Seresto collar.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, would that be better than the NexGard?
Well, they all work about the same way. And that, you know, they, in the case of the oral flea and tick products, the tick has to bite, but they die before they can transmit disease. And so you are being very good at being able to find those ticks before they've died and just fell off the dog. And so, good for you for keeping a close eye on those ticks. There are some studies. I'll have to find if I can find the website again. I've got it back in my notes someplace. But there is a group that's actually wanting to identify ticks and are able to tell you what kind of tick they are, because that's going to be really helpful with knowing what kind of diseases those ticks may be transmitting. So I like the oral products for my dogs because with having three of them, they play together and I'm afraid they're going to pull each other's collars off. So I don't particularly like to use as something external. Plus, they like to roll in the dirt when I put something topical on them. So I like the oral products for my dogs. They're not perfect for everybody, especially if your dog has some underlying neurologic problems, especially seizures. You might want to be a little careful because even though it's very uncommon, neurologic complications are associated with all of the oral flea and tick products. What the Seresto collar is it's made by the Bayer Company. And it lasts for approximately 8 months. But you have to be careful if your dog is swimming a lot or you're bathing them a lot. Even if you may take the collar off, the chemical is coming off of the dog's body. And when you put the collar back on, it has to repopulate the body. And so it's going to take the oomph out of the collar much sooner. And so dogs that are in the water a lot, being bathed a lot, may only last for about 5 months. But it is a very, very effective collar to use. And it's safe around people, too. So that's one of the nice things about using it.
Yeah, that's great. Chris, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Jackie. It's something a little different here, so let's go there. She in Michigan says she has a 10-year-old treeing Walker Coonhound that's been having problems with clear discharge in her left nostril. Started in December with inverted sneezes. Humidifier helped, but by January, the discharge started. Her vet did some blood work. Everything was fine and tried antibiotics a number of times, but hasn't helped. He does get a bloody nose occasionally after sneezing from the left nostril. There doesn't seem to be any airflow from that side.
Ooh.
Yeah, he has great appetite, peppy on his walks, but she's worried about potentially nose cancer.
Yeah. You know, and this is something that was the first thing that went through my head. Being a 10-year-old dog that has one-sided nasal discharge that has been persistent now for several months, that's not antibiotic responsive, things that I would be thinking about would be, does this dog have a foreign body up there? Being a coonhound, they've got their nose in everything. And sometimes we'll find blades of grass or seeds or anything up in that nasal passage. And so that could potentially be a problem. And that would be really good news for this dog. But the other things that we would be thinking about would be fungal infections that could only be on one side, maybe a nasal tumor. And I think what this caller needs to do is, if their veterinarian does not have the capability, and most vets in private practice don't have the ability to do CT scans in their own practice, but this dog probably needs to have a skull CT scan done to be able to look at the nasal passages and the sinuses to see what's involved and if there's any bony changes. And then after that's done, looking up the nostril and even going around the back and looking up the backside of the from the throat up into the nostrils with a scope to be able to see what's going on and potentially get biopsies. It's interesting that this dog is doing this reverse sneeze. We'll sometimes call that a pharyngeal cough. And just to give you an example, I had a dog in not too long ago that did this every once in a while. It's very common for dogs to get this snorting type behavior. But this dog just was doing it over and over and over again. And it turned out it had a tooth root abscess that had blown into the nasal passage through the bone. And once that tooth was removed, it stopped doing its reverse sneezing. So that was causing enough post-nasal drip and so on and irritation that it was triggering this response that the dog was doing. And I think that this owner is obviously very observant, has already talked to the veterinarian and done some trials of easy things, but now it gets to the hard stuff.
Let's take another call here. Lindsay from Ashland up next. Lindsay, hi, what's on your mind?
Thank you much for taking my call. So we have a two-year-old Shih Tzu, and she has been having issues with itching. We've had her to the vet many times, and we've tried Benadryl, Zyrtec, and now she's on something called, I think I'm saying it right, chlorpheniramine. And she's taking 2 milligrams twice daily, and it doesn't seem to be helping. So we're just wondering what our next steps are. She constantly licks her paws. She's constantly itching, and we're not really sure what our next step should be.
Well, there's three main causes of itch, and some of them we can rule out very easily. One is parasites, and so having your dog on preferably one of the oral flea and tick products is very helpful, because even though they are labeled for fleas and ticks, they also get some of the mites that cause itch, like scabies and Calathiella. The fact that your dog's licking its feet, unlikely to be parasites, but always that possibility. And that's an easy thing to get off the table. The next thing that can cause itch is infection. And infections rarely just come on their own. They're usually secondary to something like allergies. But you're not going to get the itching under control unless you address the secondary infections. And so having your veterinarian do some impression smears of the area between the toes or on the bottoms of the feet, any place that's involved, to look for yeast or bacteria that may need to be treated either systemically or topically, sometimes with medicated shampoos, would be very, very helpful. And then once we get that under control, then we start looking at what's causing your dog to itch, and we think it probably is going to be something allergic. Food allergies are very uncommon in dogs. They account for about 10% or less of the allergies that we see, but it is one of those things that we can rule out by putting your dog on a diet trial, and that would mean going on a hydrolyzed protein diet and using that and only that for a good probably 6 to 8 weeks, closer to 8 week period of time. And that would even mean that you'd have to probably change if you're using a beef-based heartworm preventative to something else, getting rid of treats, dental chews, rawhides, everything, and seeing if that doesn't make your dog better. The drugs that you're currently using, everything you have listed are all antihistamines. And antihistamines just don't work well for dogs. It helps maybe take the edge off some dogs, but they're tend to be very ineffective. And so you've just jumped from one antihistamine to another to another. And all three of them, I would have probably given up after one. But you've tried them all and your dog's still itchy. So if there's no infection, one of the drugs that your dog may be able to go on would be something like, there's a drug called Apoquil, which is an oral pill that is not a steroid, but it works on the itch receptors. And some dogs do very well with that medication. There's also an injectable type of immune therapy that we use that goes by the name of Cytopoint. And some vets carry both of those things, and others just carry one or the other. Cytopoint usually has to be used every 4 to 8 weeks, depending on the dog. And that's something that is going to maybe very helpful for your dog as well. Ultimately, being a two-year-old dog, you'd probably want to find out why your dog is allergic anyways. And so that would mean maybe thinking about doing some allergy testing. And blood testing works very well for environmental allergies as an initial screen, does not do anything for food allergies. You really have to do that diet trial to rule that out. So you can see this is kind of a complicated thing. We start with one thing and keep jumping, you know, to the next. But if you go about it systematically, we can get to the bottom of your dog's itch and make them feel much more comfortable. But I think good the luck. Apoquil would probably be a good choice for your dog.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her come by. So your dog or your cat have an issue? We've talked quite a bit about Lyme disease, but we can take other questions in that area and others as well. So give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call next from Maddie from De Pere. Maddie, hi.
Hi. I had a friend near Wapaka who took her dog in, and he was identified to have Lyme disease, but they did something called a snap check or something like that, mm-hmm. where it took a minimum of blood. Mm-hmm. But the big thing that I want to ask you about is he said that the vet said he could tell how long the dog had it by how dark the spot was.
Oh, no. So what, I mean, if you look at the snap test that we're using, it's very similar to like a pregnancy test for people. And it's just a little platform that will, a line will show up that'll be blue for whether they're positive or not. And sometimes we will see them be a light blue, sometimes a dark blue. But that doesn't tell you how long they've been infected. And it's just, I kind of look at a positive as a positive. It's kind of like being a little bit pregnant, you know, it's just,
yeah.
You know, it's still positive. So I just want to just bring up the fact that you said the dog was diagnosed with Lyme disease. Lyme disease is the actual clinical form of a Lyme infection. And the great majority of dogs that get exposed to Lyme are never symptomatic. And so just because a dog tests positive doesn't mean they actually have the disease. They may be positive persistently. And one of the things that we recommend is, you know, not forgetting about that fact that those dogs can develop that serious Lyme nephritis, and at least a couple of times a year have a urine sample checked for that urine protein creatinine ratio. But, you know, when we get a dog that tests positive, we don't automatically treat because we know that they've probably been infected for months, and treatment does not seem to affect whether they're going to develop disease down the road. And so it is one of these kind of controversial things, but we don't want to overuse antibiotics, and there's no evidence that treatment with doxycycline will reduce the incidence of disease later on. So we usually only treat the dogs that are either symptomatic or checking positive for protein in their urine, which makes us afraid that they may be developing this really severe complication.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. We'll move next to Marilyn from Superior. Marilyn, hello to you.
Hi. In February, we were coming down a hill, and it was a beautiful day, but a semi-truck that had some ice up on the top of it, threw the ice on our windshield and on our back window and destroyed both of them. But ever since then, our dog has been shaking once we get in the car.
Oh, poor thing. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, I think I would be, too. Yeah. I mean, I think anytime I'd get in the car and, you know, it's icy or another big vehicle is passing, I'd be thinking twice about, you know, keeping my eyes open, looking at the windshield. But, oh, boy, what do we do about your dog? I think a number of things that you could try would be, you know, just getting your dog desensitized to just being in the car without the engine running. And so now that the weather's getting a little bit nicer, you may want to look at, you know, just taking your Sunday paper out there and sitting in the car with the bag of treats with the doors open and let the dog decide whether they want to even come over near the car. If they do get in the car, obviously lots and lots and lots of treats. That would be one way of just getting them comfortable with getting in and out of the car. You gradually increase that to perhaps starting the engine, maybe shutting the doors. And it's helpful to have somebody else sitting next to the dog so that they can be giving the dogs little bits of freeze-dried liver or anything that would be really tempting to make your dog wanting to sit in the car and not be nervous. And you don't want to go to from one step to the next until your dog is saying, hey, I'm comfortable with this. I don't mind being in the car. I don't mind the engine starting. I don't mind the door shut. And so watching for signs of stress, which would be dilated pupils, panting, especially pulling their lips back, ears back, cowering, anything like that would be a sign that you're going a little too fast. And so you're wanting to desensitize your dog. Sometimes we have no choice, but we have to put the dog in the car because we've got to go someplace. And you may want to just change the way the dog rides in the car, perhaps putting them in a crate so that they're covered up and they're not having to look out the windows or see what's going on. So you've changed the environment from being loose in the car to being in a crate. That may help. You may want to talk to your veterinarian about other drugs that you could use that are anti-anxiety medications that may take the edge off of your dog. And those would be things like clonidine is one drug that we use, any of the benzodiazepines like Xanax or Valium, depending on your dog. There's different ones that we can use that would be very safe. But start working now. And if you can work with an applied animal behaviorist, you're probably going to find that the desensitization program is going to go a lot easier and faster for you.
And I remember Dr. Patricia McConnell talking about the first stages are always the ones where people try to rush through, and they're the hardest ones. And
those are the hardest, yes.
Things get quicker as you go along.
Definitely. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Yep.
And Marilyn, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Next, we go to Ron in Beulah, Michigan. Ron, hello to you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have an 8-year-old black lab, and we try to walk about 3 miles a day, which we both enjoy. But I'm concerned about keeping her joints as healthy as possible so we can do this for many more years. And I'm confused about, I'm thinking it might be the time to start a joint supplement. But when I've tried to look up online, you know, they say Cosequin is the most recommended, and Dazoquin, and there are others that have turmeric and other things. Can you tell me, is this a good time?
Definitely. I think starting any time would be okay. There's not a lot of really good evidence that these are super helpful, but the thing is they're not going to hurt. And so the reason why drugs like Dazoquin and Cosequin happen to be recommended is that many of the companies that make joint supplements, they're very poorly regulated. And this isn't true for human supplements as well. And so that happens to be one of the companies that they put a lot of effort into making sure that you know you're getting what's actually in that, you know, in the supplement that you're using, that it's just not on the label, but it's actually in the product. I know that our orthopedic surgeons will usually recommend Dazoquin, or there's one called Dazoquin Advanced that they use as well. And there's other products out there that would probably be very, very similar. The one supplement that in the veterinary world, we've actually got some evidence-based results to show that they do get better with it is fish oil. And fish oil, you can buy it just at the big box stores. You don't have to buy an actual veterinary product, but you do have to give it at a correct dose. And it's a pretty high dose. We start usually much lower and gradually work up to it, but it's about 100 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. So about 50 milligrams per pound of body weight. So that's a lot of fish oil. But that would be something that at least some of the research that's been done at the veterinary school has shown that dogs actually bear weight better when they're using that. But it can take a couple of months to start taking effect. So it's not one of these overnight things that you're going to see. You just have to be hopeful and keep your dog on something like that. Obviously, you can get these types of products in diets, and there are some therapeutic diets that are available from your veterinarian or via prescription. You can get them online through some of the online pharmacies that carry pet foods. One of them is called JD, made by the Hill's Company. Another one's called JM, by the Nestle Purina Company. But that would be something that you could try as well as one of these joint diets. And then the last thing to look into is an injectable joint supplement it's a glycosaminoglycan that we use, and it's called Adequin Canine. And I have some owners actually using that, and they learn to give injections to their dogs, and it's on a more frequent schedule to begin with, and then we get down to just using it about monthly. And sometimes that is a very effective thing. And so lots of different things to consider trying, but I think your first bet is get your dog on some fish oil and consider one of the over-the-counter supplements like Dasaquin or Dasaquin Advanced.
Now, here's me taking fish oil every day. If I take some fish oil without having some food in me, I get a little queasy stomach.
Oh,
does the same hold for dogs?
It does. It does. And so I use fish oil for all three of my dogs, and it's just part of their daily routine, and it gets given with their evening meal. And so I have my list of who gets what, and because I'm not there to give them dinner most of the time, my husband has to have his little list and go down the list of who gets which medication, and they get their fish oil hidden in a little bit of food and with their bowl of food as well. And it does help settle the stomach a little bit.
There you go, Ron. Thank you so much for calling. Joanne in Green Bay, it's your turn now. Hi, Joanne.
Hi there.
What's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two cats. One is Connor. He's about 3 years old. He came from Craigslist. He came as a kitten. He probably was not well socialized. Or didn't have time to be socialized. The other one's a female, and she's 1 year younger than Connor, so she's about 2 years old. She's a rescue kitten. 95% of the time, they're best friends. The problem occurs when they're together and they're sitting on the same little pad or blanket, and they're grooming each other like crazy and look like they're loving each other and so on and so forth. And Connor will go lick, lick, and all of a sudden he will munch down and grab a bunch of fur and pull. He'll come up with what looks like a false beard. It's really funny because it's all this fur he has pulled off the other cat. The other cat sits there, doesn't do anything. Well, once in a while, he pulls off too much fur and there's a yelp. So, of course, that's what gets my attention. But right now, there's a little raw spot just behind her ear because he has pulled off enough fur that he is down to the skin.
Oh, my goodness.
And what I have done is I've noticed that Connor sometimes will play with what I call his rat. It's bigger than a mouse, toy mouse.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 3 inches long, maybe. And it's got furry fur on it. And I noticed that he pulls on that fur sometimes.
I assume they're both neutered, spayed and neutered, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Spayed and neutered.
Okay.
And what I've done to distract them is I watch them very closely. I'm home most of the time. But I can just about tell when, this is going to happen. And it's not an attack. There's no meowing. There's no swiping of paws. There's no spitting and that kind of stuff. But I say, who wants a treat? And all of a sudden, they both perk up.
Yeah.
And they refer to me. I give each one a treat. And that's the end of it.
Yeah,
they don't go back to petting and all this kind of stuff, So I'm just wondering what I can do to, or what's with Connor? What this? Connor must be lacking in something. I don't know.
Well, I just wonder, the reason why I asked if he was neutered or not, and sometimes even after neutering, many cats will still have kind of mating-type behaviors. And male cats, when they're mating with a female cat, will bite them at the nape of the neck, and that's part of the normal mating ritual. And so it may be kind of just something that's hardwired in him to do that. Sometimes it's just they're overstimulated by something, and I don't know if they're looking at something outside and he's just redirecting a bite to her, but in that case, I would expect some growling or hissing or something, and you're not seeing that as well. Very, very interesting. I the fact that you can change their motivational state and get him to not do that by giving him treats, I'm just wondering if, you know, you can, you know, just train him to, you know, be sitting there for a while and come to you more frequently, or provide them with, you know, separate resting areas so that you've got more space for them to be in, so that in case he is getting overstimulated by having her sitting next to him, they're at a little bit, you know, different area. I was just at a meeting, and I'm drawing a blank on the space, but there was somebody that reported that this was a cat behavior lecture that I went to, that each cat needs something like 1,400 square feet. Okay, so, you know, if you've got a small home and two cats or an apartment, they just don't have enough space. So we really have to start thinking vertically to be able to provide them with the space that they need. So adding in another resting area, hopefully that would help. But, you know, putting something on the back of the cat's neck, boy, that would be really tough to do. Put a bandage on it or something that is she's going to tolerate, that is not going to allow him to bite at the area. I'd have to do some brainstorming to figure out what you could use. You know, they do make things like the thunder shirts for cats. And if the bite area is down low enough, that may protect it. So that would be something to talk to your vet. Is there something that we can do to provide her with some kind of protective device to keep him from injuring her?
Connor sounds like one of those cats that jumps up on your lap and you pat him for a while and then suddenly he bites you.
Yeah, they just reach that point of being very overstimulated, and you'll start, you know, if you're really careful with watching these cats, you'll start seeing things like their tail will just start to twitch, or the skin on their back may start to twitch a little bit. Their ears may go back just a smidge, and if you're looking at their face, their pupils may become either a little more dilated or a little more pinpoint, kind of depending on the cat, and then the attack happens. And so that may be what's going on. And you know, when that's happening with people, we just tell owners, you know, let them be on your lap for a very brief period of time, and then just stand up and let gravity do its thing and get the cat off of your lap and redirect them to something else.
Thank you very much for calling, Joanne. Appreciate your call. Randy emailed to ask if he should be concerned about buying a puppy from a breeder who smokes.
That is a really interesting question, because we know that with cats, so we're not talking about dogs, but with cats, because they are down on kind of carpet and floor level, and the carcinogens from smoking land on that area, we see an increase in intestinal tract cancer in cats from homes where there are smokers. There have been some reports of increased nasal cancers and things in dogs, especially long-nosed dogs. Again, you know, proof and the actual, like, you know, saying this is how much they have to be exposed to, we don't know, but it's just a theory that that may be something that are one of the causative environmental causes for doing this. You know, besides the fact that the puppies are going to smell funny, you know, I think probably not a huge deal, although, you know, if they're coming with any secondary respiratory problems, I'd be thinking twice about it, you know, you know, if you've got a dog that's like a push face dog, one that bulldogs, pugs and so on that are already having trouble breathing, being in a real smoky environment could really aggravate those nasal passages and cause more problem. But perhaps getting them out into a new home would get them back right on track again.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's take another call. Faye in Wausau, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
This is a wonderful program. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I have three cats. It's the cat day. And one, the newest one is about 8 months, and it's one of those wild ones, not a trapezoid, but what are they?
The feral cat?
No, no, the two-colored wild. They're, they run kind of. Well, anyway, that's the latest one. Tortoiseshell.
Okay.
And they're more active, right?
Not necessarily. That's just a color combination. They tend to sometimes in the veterinary world, you'll hear veterinarians saying like calico cats can sometimes be a little more temperamental or tortoiseshells, but there really isn't any evidence that that's the case.
But something's going on. Faye, what's going on?
Woman.
Sorry?
And she's been fixed, and then I have a 9-year-old cat, and the old one is 18. Okay, this 18-year-old cat started urinating next to my bed.
Ah.
So, and I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, I found her doing that a couple of times, and so I put a litter box there. Well, they all use the litter box. And now just about a month ago, she went in another room where there was a basket and urinated in there. And I also got this Pheromone plug-in, thinking that would maybe help.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't noticed anything now since I took the basket out and cleaned in the other room. But I don't want to have the 18-year-old is an active kitty cat, and I don't want to have him put down, and I'm wondering what my next step is.
Well, the first thing I would do is, being an 18-year-old cat with a new behavior problem eliminating out of the box, you've got to rule out medical problems. Is your cat hyperthyroid? Does it have kidney disease, a urinary tract infection, something that could be making them make more urine? The other things that we want to look at is your cat arthritic? So being really careful to be watching how your cat makes it into the litter box or up and down stairs, because arthritic cats sometimes have a trouble getting into a box with high sides, or if the box is in a really difficult spot to get to, like down some basement stairs, the cat's going to pick something that's nice and absorbent, like the carpet next to your bed. And so always rule out medical things first, and then we have to start looking at, you know, how the toileting issues having three cats in your house. Ideally, you'd want to have four litter boxes that are all big. And when we say big, at least 1.5 times the length of your cat from head to tail, and not covered, and with a couple of inches of soft, unscented, scoopable litter in it that you clean out daily, so that we've got now the golden toilets for your cats. And you don't want to have them near where they're eating or near noisy appliances. And so you've really got to sit down and look at your house. And I think you were very smart with putting a litter box in your bedroom. Obviously, that's a preferred toilet area. Unfortunate for you, but lovely for your cats. And I would be putting another litter box where that basket was in the other room, because obviously that is a spot that the cat likes to go in. You know, go from there. But really get your cat in. If you've not had them into the vet yet, you've got to get that done, because there definitely could be a medical cause for this.
My litter box is, the both cats will be in there, sometimes go in there at the same time.
Well, you're very lucky, you know. I have two cats. I have three litter boxes, and they definitely each uses their own, and then the third just sits there, and every once in a while it'll get used because it's in a totally different location. It's on a second floor of the house, and once in a while they'll get up there, but you do have to provide for that. So a litter box in every floor of the house. You're lucky that your cats will do that, but you know, I personally don't want someone in the bathroom with me, and you know why? You know, and cats are often the same way. They want a clean toilet privacy.
I can understand that. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us. Love to see your pet photos. And you can email us your questions as well to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us your photos and questions to ideas@WPR.org. And Sandy, Teresa sent us a couple of nice photos of her red heeler, Ty.
Oh, look at that beautiful dog. Now, yeah. That is a dog that is a high-energy dog, you know? They really are a dog that, I mean, when you see these dogs, they are doing a lot of agility work and herding work and, oh, my goodness. But I have a family that their son has one, and he comes to visit, and they're like, how can we keep this dog, you know, busy when it's at our house? And I'm like, oh, I don't know, because normally he lives in Montana where he's got cows to work
run,
with.
Run. Well, thanks for sending those photos. And we have Gary in Madison up next. Gary, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. We have approximately a 9-year-old rescue dog. We've had him for about 8 years now. And we also have an Instapot, one of those modern day pressure cookers.
Yep.
And what we've noticed every time we use it is he gets stressed out. His tail is down and he wants to get out of the kitchen area and actually wants to go outside. And we can't detect any sound that the Instapot is making. And there's no steam or anything coming out of it. And we thought it might be a sound, but also, over Easter, my wife was making some eggs in one of those egg things where you cook them, and he did the same thing, the same reaction, and we're just kind of wondering, is he hearing something, you know, where there's dog whistles that we can't hear, but we don't know. Or what's agitating?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never used an I've never used an Instapot before, so I don't know if they do make
one.
And does it make some sound?
It'll make a little
like
hiss,
a hissing, a high pitch hiss,
a high pitch, a very high pitch.
Okay. Yeah, so it's very possible that your dog is hearing something. And, you know, for many cases, it either is related to something that happened to your dog in the past. Maybe a similar sound was linked to something else. I was thinking that if it made like a funky beeping sound or something, perhaps when it was done, it would, maybe it's similar to the beep from like an invisible fence collar or, you know, a dog training collar type of thing. But it can even be when we see dogs afraid of things that they shouldn't be. Sometimes it's linked to something else that happened, like maybe the Instant Pot was making that high-pitched hiss and something came crashing down in the kitchen, a pot hit the floor, and that scared the dog. So now they've linked that, oh, when I'm in the kitchen and that thing's plugged in making that sound, something bad's going to happen. I would start with maybe, if you could, just having the device out while your dog is just in the kitchen, happy and relaxed, and getting them comfortable with just being around the device. And then, you know, gradually perhaps having them, be, you know, come closer and closer to it while it's plugged in. So maybe having it plugged in a place like a closet where it can be behind a door or with a box over it so it's blunting the noises so that the dog gets used to it from a distance, and having all that interaction be really wonderful and pleasant for your dog. And again, just like that caller that had the dog that was afraid of getting in the car after a windshield broke, where we said you've got to go about this slowly, this is what you're going to have to do with this thing too. And it's a matter of trying to investigate and try to figure out what it is that's triggering this, whether it's the pot itself or a noise or something else you're doing in the kitchen while that's out.
There are some buttons you have to push, and there's some little beeps if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and they can really mimic you know, some of the different training collars. And with this dog being a rescue, who knows what he went through that first year of life.
Yeah, yep. So it could be those.
Because I have dogs that when we're checking their microchip, we scan them and the machine makes a beep sound. And when that makes the beep, some dogs that are with the training collars will react because they think that, oh, the next step is I'm going to get a shock because that's the first sound that they hear. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Janine in Green Bay, your turn. And then we'll go to Josh in who's traveling through the state.
Who's traveling through the state?
That doesn't sound good. Oh.
Hello?
Hello, Janine?
Yes?
What's on your mind today?
Oh, a silly mind. I happened to be at the doctor yesterday, and I noticed something she hadn't noticed on the board. We have toilet tissue, don't we?
Yeah.
What about these countries? And I was wondering about animals. Do they have any problems with not being clean enough or something?
Well, funny you bring that up. I have a dog that the way he's built, he's a 8-month-old bulldog, and he has his rectal area is kind of underneath, tucked under a tail that is a little bit tight. And so every once in a while, he gets some Klingons, and I have to clean his rear end. So I'm one of those dog moms that has to have diaper wipes sitting by the back door, and we do the look, and I hate to say this, but sniff test once in a while, too, to see, do you need to be wiped or not? And that's this is one of those things you do when you have a dog like that. But typically, I think it's just anatomical differences. Dogs don't have the same anatomy that we do, where we have cheeks and a recessed anus. Theirs are more protruding and out for the world to see. It may be having to do with fecal consistency, because sometimes even dogs that have a normally situated tail and rectum, if they have soft stools, they need to often have a cleanup job afterwards. And that usually means that the owner's bringing it to our attention and we're seeing them at the vet clinic to deal with why they're having diarrhea. So it's just anatomical difference and then breed related difference and difference anatomy in the dogs makes all, whether you have to have wipes available or not.
And Janine, thanks for calling. Josh is traveling through Wisconsin from Indiana, has a question for us. Hi,
hey,
Josh.
Guys, hey, how you doing?
Good.
I have a schnoodle, my wife and I do. It's 8 pounds, about 10 years old. In the last few years, we've been seeing problems with it keeping down its food. We've tried different types of foods. We've tried multiple small meals throughout the day on flat plates with a little bit of food so she's not eating too fast. And we still cannot pinpoint why she cannot keep down the food. It happens 2 to 3 times a week, I'd say.
Okay. A few things that I worry about. One would be, making sure that your dog doesn't have any underlying organ problems, because vomiting is a symptom that can be from pancreas and kidneys and liver and all kinds of things. It may be a motility disorder. It could be dietary hypersensitivity. So often what we will do with these dogs is initially try them on a hypoallergenic diet, which would be a hydrolyzed protein diet, making sure that we also have ruled out intestinal parasites as a cause. And part of that may be looking at, there's a stomach worm that is quite common in our area that's called Physalopteria. And that particular parasite is very difficult to find. We don't see it on a stool sample. And so sometimes we'll just go ahead and go through a therapeutic deworming for that particular parasite. And it's a little bit different than other parasites. We have to use a drug called Pyrantel at double the dose for 3 treatments at 2-week intervals, I believe, is what we have to do. So if the dog is not acute and not, feeling really ill and the blood work's all normal, I would go through a therapeutic deworming. If the dog doesn't get better, hypoallergenic diet. If the dog doesn't get better, then I refer them to one of my internist buddies and say this dog needs to have an upper GI and perhaps some imaging done to see if we have a motility disorder, some type of obstructive disease. And there we go.
We start
looking at for some of those weird and wonderful things. But I think you could probably get to the bottom of this.
something to ponder as you drive through Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Josh, for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve emailed that he would like to mention the need to keep cats in the house and not let them wander outside in the neighborhood. He's a bird guy and reminds that cats kill more birds than pretty much anything else.
And that is correct. And so, yes, definitely we know that cats live longer when they're kept inside. What I like to see cats, if they you want to have them outside, build them a catio, which would be like a screened-in area. They even make some commercially that are available that are little pop-up houses that cats can go out in that will protect the birds and protect the cat as well from predators and different diseases. The things that are like the bird-catching bibs and the big clown collars they wear, cats can get around those things, and we see them still catching birds with even those on. So safest thing is keep your cats indoors.
Yeah, I think Joy Cardine and Joy and her husband Rob Starbuck have a little tent, they call it, mm-hmm. for the kitty.
Yeah.
They put
yeah.
the kitty in that.
Yeah. I saw this one just the other day that's this tunnel that is all collapses down and it goes out to a pop-up tent for your cat. So you can have it in different places in your yard and have it connected to a window so that the cat can get in and out on their own. And when the weather's nice, what a great idea. They do make fencing for your backyard, but cats know how to get around it. Like it's a, it looks almost like you're in a penitentiary, the way it's like set up in the yard. But I've had some cats learn to get around that, and other cats get in the yard, and it doesn't prevent them from catching birds.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So keep your cats indoors, like I do.
Yes, like I do as well.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, Bill in Green Bay, we'll get to him next. But we need to take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back right up until about 12:30 today to take your questions. Again, the number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us your questions and photos to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back right after the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks so much for joining us today. You can reach us with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Bill in Green Bay has been waiting a bit, so let's go to Bill. Thanks for waiting, Bill. What's on your mind?
I have a border collie Australian mix. She's going on 7 years old, and her whole life she's been crazy for the tennis ball. She's run for it 30, 40 times. You know, if you can throw it that many times. And recently she was diagnosed with hip dysplasia, and they gave me some tramadol and some of that Dasmin supplements. She refused to take the Dasmin supplements, even if I put it in, you know, roast beef, she won't touch it. But her life has changed a lot. She's just not the same dog, and I'm wondering if there's any alternatives besides tramadol. She takes that, but all she doesn't sleep.
Yeah, unfortunately, hip dysplasia is one of these things that, you know, often you can try to prevent it through very thorough, like breeding programs and so on. But we know that there, although there's a strong a genetic component to it, there's also an environmental component as well. And what hip dysplasia is just the hip is a ball and socket joint. And instead of being nice and smooth where it's cartilage rubbing on cartilage, you start getting flattening and laxity in the joint, and the cartilage wears out. So you start having bone on bone grinding. And that's what ends up causing all this pain, is the resulting arthritis that occurs. So it's basically hip arthritis. And so anything that we do for arthritis, such as weight control, making sure your dog is at a normal weight, going on a joint specific diet, which would be one way of getting some of those supplements in that you're not able to do by giving them, like you're trying the Dasaquin and she's not eating that. Going back to the fish oil thing, that would be another thing to consider trying. And it's available in different formulations from through veterinary companies, but even using the human fish oil from the big box store would be fine, just getting it at the right dose of 100 milligrams per kilogram, starting slow and gradually working up to that. But other things that you may want to be looking into would be actual pain control. Tramadol, being an opioid receptor blocker, you would think it would be a fairly effective pain control for arthritis, but we actually find that it doesn't work that well. And you'd probably be better off having your dog on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory that would be specific for dogs. And that would be something like Rimadyl or Deramax, or there's a whole host of them on the market, depending on which one your veterinarian feels most comfortable with. Obviously, when we use those, we have more risk of gastrointestinal issues and liver complications. And so we tend to do some monitoring when we have dogs on it long term. But your dog may only need to be on it just, you know, periodically when it's sore. Look into physical therapy as well, because I think that that would be something that for your active dog, there may be some exercises and things that we can do that would help strengthen the muscles around the hips so that we get better support. And that may even include doing some underwater treadmill work or swimming, which your breed of dog may not appreciate that, but they can still do it. Where I live in Janesville, we actually have an indoor dog pool that they do physical therapy in. And then we start looking at surgery. And I'm not sure how much your dog weighs, but dogs over 40 pounds really don't do well with a femoral head and neck osteectomy, where you can make a false joint. But you can be looking into, since your dog is 7 and has but hopefully a long life ahead of them, maybe total hip replacement. And that is something that is done in dogs, not just in people.
Well, you know, I had some kind of a sore knee, and I had some simvastatin shot up in my knee.
Mm-hmm.
Are there similar kinds of...
Using a joint injection, steroid injections we typically don't use in dogs, and I don't know why, but they do use it in people typically for things like tendonitis and things like that. And I don't know what the drug is that you were talking about. My guess is it's probably some type of a joint supplement like our glycosaminoglycans. I'm not sure.
I had to have 3 shots over a period of 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's probably what that is. And that would be similar to what this drug I mentioned earlier called Adequin Canine, which is we don't inject it in the joint of the dog. We do in horses, but we give it under the skin, and it supposedly helps dogs and gets into the joint and makes them feel a little more comfortable. So, yeah.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Phil in Madison next. Phil, hi.
Hi. I had a concern about my 12-year-old lab husky German Shepherd mix.
Yeah.
He's been waking me up at night. He'd be not panting hard, but he wakes up panting. I was wondering if that's a discomfort or be more heart-related.
Oh, it could be anything. I mean, sometimes we just know that, if your dog has arthritis or something, they may be uncomfortable. And so if you're noticing that your dog is showing during waking hours some types of joint discomfort, limping, going slow up and down stairs, maybe worthwhile addressing it from that standpoint. But we do see a number of other things. You mentioned heart disease. Most dogs with heart disease, yes, they are going to have increased respiratory rate when they start to go into heart failure, which is often accompanied by a cough and not panting. So heart disease itself would be unlikely. There are a couple of tumors. There's one that can that we can see on the heart called a chemodectoma. There's a tumor on the adrenal gland called a pheochromocytoma. Both of those, one of the things that we can see is them waking up and panting. And so, there's all kinds of weird and wonderful things, but we got to get the common things out of the way. Is your dog overweight and they're waking up hot? Is your dog painful? Does your dog have some type of anxiety-related issue? Because 12-year-old dogs will often get some dementia, and we do see sometimes them being disoriented at night, and that could be part of it as well. And so we do some specific questioning and testing for all of these things to try to figure out what could be causing your dog's problem. I'm jumping all over the place here, but even something like Cushing's disease, which is diagnosed by doing some blood tests and also by looking at your dog. Sometimes they have some very unique physical characteristics. That's an adrenal gland problem. They'll pant with that as well. So I think it's time to get to your veterinarian, get a good thorough physical done, get some lab work done, have that heart listened to, although it's probably not your dog's heart, and then start paying attention to other symptoms that your dog may have, such as pain during the day or other signs of dementia to help with getting a diagnosis.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Lee emailed us to say that she has a 3.5-month-old female black lab rescue with a bladder infection. Her vet put her on amoxicillin, and the dog seems more lethargic than expected. Wonders if it's the meds or the infection.
It could be either, although we don't typically see a bladder infection except for causing the bladder spasming and discomfort. It can, on rare occasions, spread to the kidneys and really make them sick and painful. It's called pyelonephritis, but I wouldn't be expecting that in a 3.5-month-old dog. The antibiotic itself, although generally very safe and often doesn't cause any side effects, can upset the tummy and make them feel ill. Making sure that you're giving it with food and, you know, only treat long enough to get that infection under control. And I think as veterinarians, one of the things that we do is we typically treat for like 7 to 10 days for an infection. And some of the research out there, especially in people, and now we're starting to get it back in dogs too, say that we may not have to treat that long. So perhaps taking another urine sample in while your dog's on antibiotics to see if the infection is cleared. So maybe we can end that antibiotic treatment if it's just a simple urinary tract infection.
And she also mentions that apparently she has a 16-year-old dog that likes to lick the other dog's belly. Is that going to keep it from going away? And then she wonders, will the infection be a lifelong issue?
Well, the infection shouldn't be. It's very common for little girl dogs to get infections just because they typically have a little bit of puppy vaginitis. That may be what's driving their 16-year-old dog to lick the dog's belly. And so looking for evidence of vaginitis, evidence of skin infections that may be driving your dog to other dog to lick back there, I'd be trying to prevent that if possible. It sounds like it's kind of an endearing thing to have both dogs bonding that way. But that may be just having that saliva and stuff all back there could be causing some of these issues. So but having a lifelong infection would mean you've got something like an abnormal bladder or urethra or something anatomically that could be a problem, which you don't want to have. So I wouldn't even consider going there because that would be really uncommon.
Kim in Prairie du Chien, it's your turn now. Hi, Kim. Thank you for calling. Kim, are you there? Yeah, maybe we lost Kim. Well, in that case, let's go to Mary in Lebanon. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I know you were calling about feral cats, and I understand the problem. The problem is when people live in the country, we have people who dump cats.
Yeah.
And so, well, we've gotten some that were dumped. And I've gotten them somewhat used to us. They can get near and they will come, but I can't catch them, which is what I'd like to do. And then how can you get help catching these cats, and where can you take them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In our community here, we have a group called Friends of Ferals and also our local Humane Society. And that would be often the first place I would look at is your local shelters, because they may be able to help you with getting access to live traps to be able to catch these cats so that you can start getting them spayed and neutered and having the population decrease if possible. And that would be the first place I would be looking into is one of your local shelters. And I know it is a problem, and cats can reproduce very, very quickly, and it just keeps adding to the problem. And, you know, there's often in rural situations enough space and enough prey for cats to be able to survive in an environment like that. Not putting food out and things things so you're not attracting them, and making the environment more attractive to them may be helpful. But I think you're right. You're down to, as part of your duty, and now that they're on your property, is getting some live traps and getting those cats trapped and altered so that the population is stable.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Lynn emailed in central Wisconsin that she has a 5-year-old long-haired Chihuahua and a 10-year-old Boston Terrier who sometimes experiences reverse sneezing. Over the past couple of weeks, the reverse sneezing has become more frequent, 3 to 10 episodes per day. Could this be allergy-related? What could she do?
Well, this reverse sneezing is actually, it's given the name of pharyngeal cough, and it's not really a sneeze, so we're not expelling things from the nose, but it's more of a snorting type problem. I used to have to learn to imitate it, but now that there's YouTube, you just have people watch that, and they can see why dogs do it. So dogs with anything that's irritating their soft palate, so dogs with dental disease, and both of these being really small dogs, I'd be worried about, do they have underlying dental disease that needs to be addressed? I had a dog in recently that had a tooth root abscess that had gone through the bone into the nasal passage, and that's what was causing the dog to have all its reverse sneezing. Sometimes irritants in the environment, cigarette smoke, pollens, molds, and things can trigger it as well. Anything that can irritate the caudal throat area. And so I'd be thinking that a good physical by your veterinarian to see if there's anything in the oral cavity, the nasal passages that could be triggering this. There's something as simple as nasal mites. I have never personally diagnosed them, but my friends that work at the clinic that do rhinoscopy are often surprised when they put a scope up a dog's nose and see mites crawling around.
Oh.
I would expect, though, that the oral flea and tick products would get those. Don't know for sure, but they're a mite, and the oral flea and tick products like NexGard, Brevecto, Credelio, Simparica, those would all be things that would be probably effective against a nasal mite. So it might be something to look into.
Lily in Lake Nabagamon emailed that her daughter, she has a daughter, 15 months old, and she has a 45-pound male dog that loves the little girl, and the 25-pound female growls at her 90% of the time when the toddler goes near. It's been 15 months already, and that's been going on.
Oh.
Is anything she can do to help the female get over it, I would be really concerned.
I am really, really concerned. Yeah. And, you know, part of it is that toddlers don't read dog body language. And approaching, just the fact that they move different, they sound different, they're often right in the dog's face. They may, and the dog's growling for a reason, and it's usually out of fear. If you want to go down that path with an applied animal behaviorist, I would definitely keep them permanently separated. I mean, like, until you can get some help, because the risk to that young child, if they just, you know, go that next step, the dog is growling for a reason. We, you know, need to listen to that dog and say, back that child up. And I trust dogs sometimes more than children. And that, as a parent myself, obviously my daughter's much older, this would be a situation that would just have me rehoming the dog, definitely.
Yeah,
but I think getting that some assistance may help drive that point home that your dog may do better in a child-free environment.
Yeah. And I would do that sooner than later.
Yeah. Yeah. Even dogs that are well socialized around children, having them in the home, even though they may have been able to get along well with kids outside the home, now the kid is near the food bowl, near their resting area. Maybe they just can't get away. Sometimes even an older dog who has arthritis just can't get up and move fast enough to be able to get away. And if they're painful, that could be driving it. So, I get a good evaluation, not only from an applied animal behaviorist, but from your veterinarian as well. And hopefully there's nothing serious going on with the dog, that the dog can be put in another home where your child would not be at risk.
Linda in northern Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. My dog, I have a border collie. He's about 40 pounds, 4 years old. He was hit by a car on December 3rd. He was hit in the head. Nothing else was wrong, but he was paralyzed for, probably till about first or second week of February. We worked with him. We were able to have access to one of the treadmills you spoke of, the water treadmill, and yes, he hated it, and it was pretty, but it did help him. He also, we were also able to borrow a wheelchair for him. Anyway, he is walking now, but he has one leg, one of his front leg, his left front leg, is still not working well. I do have a boot that I can put on him that he really likes, and he is starting to put some weight on him, but he's got a lot of muscle atrophy there because obviously that was December and now it's April. And I'm just wondering, if you had mentioned physical therapy with dogs, is that something that's common that you can have access to? Or I don't know much about that.
Yes.
I'm working with him.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. At the vet school, we have Dr. Courtney Arnoldi, who is our physical therapist. She has a whole separate area of the clinic that she works with patients. In fact, she even worked with my own dog postoperatively. He had elbow surgery done, and it was very helpful with helping me know what to be able to do. And even as a veterinarian, I needed that help from somebody to know what proper exercises or lack of exercise he needed and things that I could do to help him regain his strength. I'm not sure if anything is going to be helped, your dog is going to be able to be helped at this point, but getting an evaluation, you may want to have a neurologist assess your dog just to see what's going on. There are some neuroelectrical studies that can be done to see if there's any help for that leg. And so making an appointment with a veterinary neurologist, and we have several at the vet school as well. And we have many people that travel from northern Wisconsin just to come down for physical therapy and to maybe see one of the specialists. You'd have to talk to your veterinarian up there to find out who is nearby that has a physical therapy facility and what are their credentials. But they are around the state. It's just a matter of finding one that's close enough to you so that you can go back frequently if you need to.
And thanks for calling. And here we are almost out of time. And I forgot to ask you about Lost Dog Awareness Day.
Yes, and it should be Lost Pet Awareness Day. But that is what today has been classified as. And so this is my chance to say, if you haven't got your pet microchipped, get them microchipped. If you haven't registered your microchip, register it. If you haven't updated your registration, get that done and make sure your collars and tags and everything are secure and on your dog and cat so that we can make sure that they get back together again. When we have pets microchipped, we know that, especially for cats, that if they're chipped, they have 20 times more likelihood of getting back to the owner again, and dogs 2.5 times more if they're microchipped than just wearing a collar.
How expensive is it?
They run about $40 for a microchip, so it varies.
That's pretty cheap.
If you inexpensive, think about and it's lifetime. Yeah, it's lifetime. So we rarely see chips fail. Yeah.
Well, that's and they last forever, then?
They last forever, yes. They're just a little piece of, like a size of rice type thing that is implanted without anesthesia, under the skin, usually in the neck area. And they also serve other purposes besides with helping relocate your pet with a, you know, if they get lost and picked up by somebody that has a scanner, they can, like all animal control agents do. They also are used for pet doors and some of the specialized feeding systems so that they read the microchip and only let one cat or dog get to the food bowl or get through the door. So lots of good uses
Lots of good uses for that $40 or so investment.
You got it. Yep.
Dr. Sandy, you're back on May 28th. We'll do it all over again.
I'll be here.
Thank you so much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of the way it goes. Tomorrow at 11, we'll learn about ginseng, which is an important Wisconsin crop. That's at 11:45. We'll talk about sandhill cranes. In the meantime, you know what? There's lots more in store here right through the afternoon. So you stay with us here on the Ideas Network.